Hey everyone, it's Abadesi, your host of Product Hunt Radio, where I'm joined by the founders, investors, and makers that are shaping the future of tech. Today, I'm joined by Cortland Allen. He is the founder and CEO of Indie Hackers. I'm really happy that Cortland agreed to do something different with this episode. I wanted to try something fun and focus on what not to do as a maker. Indie Hackers is a community of people who have successfully bootstrapped companies, found sustainable growth, and I thought there'd be a lot to learn from what Cortland has learned from his community. So, get the notepad out, because we're going to cover really important topics like what not to do when validating ideas, launching a product, finding an audience, generating revenue, and we also talk about how to recover from setbacks. This is an episode you don't want to miss. It's packed with valuable advice. Cortland Allen, thank you so much for being on the show today. You are one of my favorite people in the tech world, one of my fave founders, and I feel like I'm speaking on behalf of all of the Product Hunt community when I say you're one of our fave makers, really. You are the founder and CEO of Indie Hackers, which was famously acquired by Stripe just a few years ago. For folks who are listening and maybe aren't familiar with Indie Hackers because they've been living under a rock or something, tell us about what it is and what you do.
Well, thanks for such a wonderful intro, Abadesi. You made me feel so special. Indie Hackers is a community for makers who are interested in generating revenue from their side projects and the things that they're putting out online. So I would contrast it a little bit from Product Hunt, which is, I think, for all makers of any kind. Indie Hackers is more for entrepreneurship, business, founder-minded makers. And so the site consists of a whole bunch of different parts. There's the Indie Hackers podcast, where I will bring makers on to talk about their businesses and how they're making money. There are the interviews on the website, where we'll interview people over text. And we ask everybody to share how much revenue they're making, how they came up with their ideas, how they got their first customers, how they built it, etc. And we've done about 400 of those interviews. And then we've got a community forum right on the Indie Hackers homepage. So it's full of makers asking each other questions, you know, how did you market this side project? Or how did you find time to take, you know, time off your job to build this thing, et cetera? Just practical questions for people to sort of help each other out and help each other build successful online businesses.
I think it's incredible what Indie Hackers has been able to do. One, in terms of disseminating knowledge from, as you say, successful revenue generating businesses within the tech space, because I know so many people that find value in the meetups, in the articles. I'm one of those people myself. And then I think secondly, in like pushing forward a number of movements, one of which is to not pursue venture capital funding as a tech founder and actually think of ways to optimize for revenue, optimize for profit, basically be a sustainable company, which is incredible. But secondly, just the kind of like maker revolution in many ways, you know, folks who want to create cloud-based products or digital tools, but aren't engineers or aren't, you know, computer science grads. So leveraging the latest in no-code tools to still build an e-commerce platform or build any kind of like B2B solution. So I feel like there are a lot of macro trends that have been happening within the tech space that Indie Hackers has really helped support and grow and move forward. And that's really cool. And if anyone hasn't like listened to your podcast or read any of your interviews, they're really missing out. I love getting inspired by people who are just like, yeah, so I did this and then I tweaked this and I built this community and now I'm making millions. Because I feel like when you read tech news, it's often companies that have raised millions but don't make any money yet. And I just wonder, like, for folks who, again, aren't familiar with your story and your background, what drew you to focus on a community of makers who are, you know, building products that make money?
Before I answer that, I'll talk about what you said earlier, these different macro trends that are happening in sort of the maker community and the tech industry as a whole. And I think Indie Hackers is sort of in line with a lot of those, but it's also been made possible by a lot of those. Probably the biggest one being that it's easier than ever for anybody to hop online and make money from some sort of project or app that they built. It's never been as easy as it is today. There's more competition, yes, but the number of tools out there to make it easy for you to do it, the amount of knowledge being shared on podcasts, on Twitter, on blogs for how to overcome a lot of these hurdles that in the past were just like completely opaque. You had no idea how to do it. There's just so much out there to make it easier than ever, which means more people than ever are doing it. There's so many more people. It's like, really, I don't bat an eye if I meet somebody today who's like, oh yeah, I've got an app. I put it online. I make, you know, 10K a month from it. I don't have a job, right? I meet so many people like that. Whereas 3 or 4 years ago, it would have been exceedingly rare. Like most people didn't do that or even know that it was possible. So I think that's a lot of why Indie Hackers is possible. Why did I get into this? Because I'm an indie hacker myself. I spent a while following the traditional startup route. So I graduated from college. I started a startup. I got into Y Combinator. You know, we raised money through them. And we never really had a business model. We didn't charge money for anything. We just tried to get millions of users. And it didn't go very well. And I was kind of burned by that experience. And then we eventually did when Stripe finally went into beta. This is 2011. We finally did charge money. We charged like $5 a month for what we were doing. And a couple hundred people signed up, like right off the bat. And so I think back then I was sort of enchanted by this idea that like, oh, I don't have to raise money from investors. I don't have to like hope that there's some sort of exit opportunity in the future. I could build something and put a price tag on it and sell it to people directly and feasibly pay my rent, you know, pay my groceries, pay my bills that way and never have to work for anybody else and just be sort of a perpetual self-sustaining maker and just make things I like and support myself that way. So that's always been a dream of mine. But the problem is there is never a resource to help me do that, right? If you go to TechCrunch, there's really not people writing articles about how to be an indie hacker. They're writing articles about how to be a high-growth Silicon Valley startup founder, which I have nothing against, but it's not right for everybody, and it's not the only path out there. And in fact, it's probably the more rare, sort of weird path if you're trying to start a business is to go that route. And so in 2016, I decided that I was going to create Indie Hackers, which would be a website for people who were just like me. People who want to be indie hackers, people who want to be makers who are generating their own revenue, who want the freedom, the financial freedom to live where they want and work on whatever they want, with whoever they want, at whatever time they want. And Indie Hackers is born to really help enable that for a lot of people just like me. And so the first version of Indie Hackers was really just interviews. I would find people who were doing what I wanted to be doing, and I would ask them, hey, like, can you come on my website? Let me interview you. And by the way, you have to share your revenue numbers. And almost everybody said no, because everyone was like, who are you? Why would I share my revenue numbers on your random website? But a few people who were early adopters said yes. And that snowballed into more and more people. I think I launched on Product Hunt August 14th, 2016, and on Hacker News August 11th. And that weekend was just, it was so big. People were so excited. There's a lot of pent up, I think, emotion and like desire for something like this to exist. A lot of people who wanted to do this, but it just wasn't all in one place. You had to sort of, you know, track down these stories and hunt down people who would live this lifestyle and accomplish these goals, because it was hard to find them otherwise. They didn't get in the mainstream press because they weren't raising money. And so I guess Indie Hackers is really an extension of my own desire. And luckily for me, there's lots of other people like me who are interested in doing the same thing.
That's incredible. It's funny because in another episode of Product Hunt Radio, I got to speak to Gina Bianchini, the founder and CEO of Mighty Networks. And, you know, they're a SaaS solution to help anyone, they call them hosts, build a community, engage with the community. And one of the pieces of advice that she gave to makers who are starting out or trying to build a brand, grow a following, was to leverage their personal experiences. She's like, if I look at the most successful case studies on the platform, it's individuals who have been able to look inwards and turn this personal experience into some kind of like valuable data point or insight or even just like inspiration or idea and mobilize people around it. And I think it's incredible that you've been able to do that with Indie Hackers, which is awesome. So for this episode, as you know, yeah, so everyone who's listening, I pitched Cortland to play on this idea of what not to do when bootstrapping in the Indie Hackers community and Product Hunt community and all the other amazing online communities that support making and entrepreneurship. We often find ourselves struggling with the same problems, the same challenges. And there's so much advice out there, but I thought it could be quite fun to pick up on some of these really common themes and think of them in the context of actually what not to do. Because sometimes it's easier to avoid things and not repeat mistakes than it is to find the ideal perfect solution for you, right? Because we're all working on different things. We all have different goals and outcomes in mind. So Cortland, if you're game, we're going to go with this what not to do and start with the first theme. Are you ready?
I am game. Let's do it. Yeah, there's a lot not to do. So
okay, cool. So I wanted to start with a question that came up in Product Hunt Makers. So we recently launched Discussions, which is a place for folks to start discussions, any thread on anything they want and chat to each other. And this idea of good ideas keeps coming up. So we have makers who are like, I have thousands of good ideas and I don't know which one to start with. how do I pick which idea to start with from these thousands of great ideas that I have? So Cortland, over to you.
First thing not to do, and this is sort of a meta point, don't take advice from people who don't understand your goals or who don't share your goals. And so I can sit here and tell you how to come up with a good idea or how not to come up with a good idea, but you need to understand that I'm telling you that from like a very specific perspective where I'm an indie hacker and the kind of things that I specialize in are like, how do you take a side project or an app that you're building and get it to profitability so that you can be, you know, earn some type of freedom as a maker? If you're trying to build the next Facebook, like probably my advice won't be that good for you. Like my version of how you validate an idea and come up with a good idea won't work for you and vice versa. So I think it's always important, you know, step one, to be careful who you're taking advice from and to try to understand where they're coming from and make sure they understand what your goals are. So first step, don't blindly follow advice that you hear on a podcast like this or that you're reading a book or a blog post because it might lead you in the wrong direction. Specifically for ideas, there's a lot of stuff that you shouldn't do when coming up with an idea. Probably you need to look at what your particular issue is. So let's say you're somebody who has trouble coming up with ideas, which I think is a very common problem, right? You think, oh, I would love to work on something and I have the time to work on something, but I'm just not sure what to work on. There's a lot of things you're probably doing that are preventing you from coming up with business ideas. The first thing I'll say you probably shouldn't do is create an analogy to what a business is that is inaccurate. So the two analogies that I hear the most, well, I'll just stick with one for now, is inventions. A lot of people think a business is an invention, which is a kind of a useful analogy because you're creating something that might not have existed before, that might be valuable to somebody. But where that analogy goes wrong is an invention needs to be this entirely novel new thing, right? You need to get a patent on it because no one's ever done it before. Whereas a business is really more of a process. A business doesn't have to be completely unique. For example, if you're a developer and you teach somebody how to code, and they pay you, that's a business. Plenty of other people have taught others to code. You're not the first. You're not an inventor, but you're still a business. And I think a lot of people get frustrated and they get really just like blocked by their inability to come up with something that's completely novel and no one's ever come up with before. But I think like number one thing you should not do when trying to come up with an idea is put that constraint on yourself. Like that is not a rule in business. There are many millions of businesses that are doing the same thing that other businesses are doing, more or less, and yet are still successful, still make their founders' lives better, still make their customers' lives better, still are net good for the world. And so don't put yourself in a box. Don't give yourself that very challenging constraint right out of the box if you're an indie hacker. Let's say you are someone who does have lots of ideas, the person you described, Abidesi, who's got a ton of ideas, and it's like, how do I even know what to work on? Really, again, it comes down to what your goals are. If you're a maker and your goal is just to build things that are really fun for you, and you're not trying to make money off of them, you don't really care if they thrive and survive for years to come, like you should probably just build whatever's at the top of your list for whatever is the most interesting to work on. Because I think any other algorithm will probably lead to a lifetime of you working on not the most interesting things to you. If you're an indie hacker, I think what you probably need to do is focus. It's a little bit more difficult to build something that people are going to pay money for than it is to build something that you're just building for your own pleasure. In fact, it's a lot more difficult because people don't pay money for very many things. If you think about all the different options we have for how we can spend our day, the millions of podcasts we could listen to, books we could be reading, TV shows we could be watching, stuff we could be creating, stores we could be dropping into, websites we could be visiting. Like we do almost none of that every day. We do like a few things. So we're all incredibly picky. And we're even more picky about the things we spend money on. And so I think if you're going to be an indie hacker, you need to be very careful upfront about what your idea is going to be. And you go through a process that I would call idea validation, which is just kind of a sanity check upfront to make sure that you're not just working on an idea because it's exciting to you, but that it's got all the other parts that a business needs to work, right? So you're not just looking at like, oh, is this a cool project that I want to build? Will it be fun for me to build it? You're also looking at the market, right? Are there actual people who would use this, right? Who are those people? Do I understand them? What are they good at? What are they not good at? What do they like? What do they not like, right? What other products are they using that might help them solve the same problem I'm helping them solve? And is mine different or better in some way? You've got to look at distribution, which is, how do I get my product in the hands of people? If you build the world's best restaurant and you put it in the Sahara Desert, your distribution is crazy, like crazy bad. And so it doesn't matter, right? So if you're going to build some sort of business, you can't just have a good product idea. You need a market as well. You need to get distribution channel to actually get your product to people. You need to think about the way the price comes into things. And I think it's less an equation of like just do one of these things really well and the rest will fall into place. I think you're better off doing all of these four things sort of mediocre. But you can't ignore any of these four qualities when you're building something. So I think that's an important step to go through when you're coming up with an idea. Make sure you've at least done a sanity check on all four of those different quadrants.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. It's funny that you also, you know, kind of started off by saying, you know, work on that one that's interesting if you have the freedom to, because we were having a conversation about motivation recently and Ryan was talking about how a lot of the times motivation to work on stuff is linked to our interest in it. And I think one of the reasons why lots of makers haven't pursued some of these light bulb moment ideas that they have on their list is because they're just not that interested in them. And I think it's okay. Like, I think it's fine. Like, so much of the success of a project is down to the execution. Like, there are probably very mediocre ideas, or like you said, unoriginal ideas that are executed in a very high impact way that can lead the maker to make money or, you know, engage with an amazing following, which is really cool. And then I like this idea that you said of actually like validating the idea and like, you know, applying this framework to it, because just because you are in the earliest stages of creating doesn't mean you can't still use data to test your assumptions or to drive your decisions. So I love this idea of like idea validation with that framework. I think that's so powerful. Thank you. Okay, so we've covered ideas. The next topic I wanted to get your insight on is finding beta testers. Beta, beta, whichever accent you have. So this is something that comes up time and time again. And I want to know, what are bootstrap friendly ways to do this? And also, you know, what are things to avoid? So what not to do when finding those first folks to test your product?
Probably the biggest thing to not do is to wait a very long time to try to find your first beta testers. I would err on the side of trying to talk to people about what you're building and what you're considering building before you even write your first line of code, or if you're a no-code maker, before you even put pen to paper trying to design what you're going to do. Talk to somebody, right? Who do you think is going to be a visitor of this website? Who do you think is going to be a user of this app? And what's cool about finding your first beta testers is that, you know, there's kind of a perception that it's the hardest thing to go from zero to one, from nobody using it to, you know, one person. But I think it's actually the easiest thing, because you don't have to be clever. In fact, I would go so far as to say you shouldn't try to be clever. You should just brute force it. When you're trying to grow an app from like a million users to 2 million users, you can't brute force that. That's way too many people. You can't write a million people, you know, a handcrafted letter. You can't go talk to a million people. You'd be doing that for the rest of your life. When you're trying to go from no one's using your app to 5 or 10 people, you can easily do that. Talk to 5 relatives. Talk to 5 friends or acquaintances at work, right? Go online and research people who you might think would be good users or good audience, whatever it is that you're creating, and send them a heartfelt, personalized email, right? You can do this. And in fact, a lot of the founders that I've talked to have done this sort of non-scalable approach in the very beginning. And I think it's something that pretty much everybody can do, regardless of what your level of knowledge is as an entrepreneur or founder. You don't need to be a genius. You don't need to launch on Product Hunt and get millions of people day one. You can just brute force it and talk to people that you know, or even people that you don't know. And I think that's not only easier because you don't have to be that clever, but it's also more valuable. Because when you try to do these sort of mass launch things as your first step out the door, you don't get very good feedback. If I talk to you, Abadesi, about what I'm working on, you can actually engage with me in real time, give me feedback. I can respond to what you're saying. I can ask you questions, etc. So the whole time I'm talking to you, I'm actually learning. Whereas if I just put up a landing page and I say, hey, come check this thing out, and I kind of tell you what it does, and you look at it and you have all these objections for why you don't care, I'll never hear that from you because you just close the tab or you just go elsewhere. And so I think early on, it's really important to get your hands dirty and just like have these real conversations. And hopefully it's something that you never stop doing as long as you're working on whatever it is that you're building.
I love that. As you were saying that, it kind of reminded me of like my favorite Paul Graham essay. I feel like everyone in the startup world's like at some point in their life stumbled upon Paul Graham's essays. And he's written that one, you know, do things that don't scale. And you're so right. Like often makers are, you know, jumping forward and thinking, oh, how does this huge tech company that I admire get feedback? Oh, they do these huge campaigns and these big launches. But exactly as you described, there's so much value in having these one-to-one interactions with folks. And I know you're a big believer in that. Like you speak to your community all the time and you still go to like all the indie hacker meetups and stuff like that, right? So like literally in real life, you're talking to people.
Yeah. Can't get out of it. If I go to a meetup, there's people in front of me in person and I talk to them and I ask them what they think. You know, this kind of goes back to, I love that you referenced Paul Graham's article and that people sort of look at what bigger companies are doing. Like probably the biggest thing not to do is to copy huge companies when you're small, right? These huge companies are doing things that like you can't do and probably shouldn't do because you're much smaller. Like you wouldn't go to the gym day one and try to bench press 500 pounds because the biggest guy in the gym is bench pressing 500 pounds. You do like what people who are just slightly ahead of you are doing. Like that's what you should be looking towards. And so I think that also kind of aligns with what I was saying earlier on in the episode, that you shouldn't take advice from people who don't have the same goals as you, who aren't doing the same things as you. And one of the most troubling things, I think, for beginning indie hackers is that the easiest, you know, most visible examples of people to copy are these huge companies who are really the worst people to copy.
Yeah, that's so helpful. I don't even know if this is a fair question or if it's possible to think about it, but if one is, let's say, trying to create a consumer app for the App Store, so with a bootstrap mindset, they're not going for VC funding. They just want to create something. They've identified a problem. Maybe it's quite a personal one. They want to build a solution. Would you say there is any kind of metric or ballpark of the number of conversations they should have before they start building or before they start wireframing? And I actually have like a specific friend in mind when I'm thinking about this, because she's been doing user interviews and she's like, okay, I've got like 39. Do I go for 50? Do I go for 100? What do I do?
She should go for exactly 43. No, I think it really depends on what your goals are. I think every step of the process, you should be thinking about what the next step is and what you need to accomplish in this step to get there, right? I think if you're talking to people, it shouldn't just be aimlessly, I'm talking to people just to talk to people. It should be, I'm talking to people because I have a certain set of assumptions as to why the thing that I'm creating is going to work, right? Because I think it solves this particular problem, because I think people will use it 3 times a day, because I think people will pay X dollars for it. And what you need to do is, when you talk to people, figure out some questions that you can ask them to really test those assumptions. And when you start getting the same answers over and over again, to the point where you feel like the assumptions that you have are no longer just assumptions, but they're sort of validated by people telling you the same thing, then I think it's safe to kind of go build it. And this process, in my opinion, should never really stop, right? You start getting the same answers. Well, then you start, you know, moving on to phase two of whatever it is that you're working on, and you have new assumptions for that phase. And so you change your questions up, but you keep talking to people. It sounds like your friend is like really structured and she's got a whole process going, and it sounds like she probably already is asking very meaningful questions. And so for her, I would ask her, okay, what are your assumptions? Like, what do you need to be true for your mobile app to work? And, you know, is that coming through in the answers that you're getting from these people that you're talking to? For a lot of people, I think you don't need anything so formal, right? You just talk to 4 or 5 people in an afternoon and you just sort of sanity check what you're working on. And like, that's enough to start writing your first lines of code. And then maybe next week you have different conversations. So there's no one number for everybody, but I think it's important to keep your eye on the ball as to what you're trying to accomplish and the next step.
Amazing. That's really helpful. That also reminds me of another thing that YC talk about, and it might have been Paul Graham too, or maybe it was Michael Seibelman, but it's all about milestones. I think it's definitely Paul Graham actually. So this was like another, I guess, like framework that he recommends for like early stage founders and tech founders to think about. Map out your milestones, whatever that might be. So, you know, we're talking about idea validation or testing assumptions, or what are the essential features to have in my MVP? And I think having those milestones mapped out, of course, those milestones may change as you gain more data, but having those milestones mapped out ahead of you is a really good way to anchor the work you do. Because exactly as you said, you know, how many user interviews should you have? Okay, how long is a piece of string? What is your goal? What are you trying to move towards? And then having those milestones as the anchors to help you decide will let you know, when you have enough information to make another key decision.
And I think it makes it more fun too. I think that's a perfect summary. And I really like having like these little milestones, these little steps, because if you have a project and it's just like this miasmic blob and it's just like, yeah, I'm going to do all this stuff at some point, then it's like, it can turn into a really long slog, which is not fun. There's a lot of makers and indie hackers who build stuff and then never really release it because they get demotivated at some point during the process. But if you have a process that you've sort of broken up into like little steps, like little wins, little milestones, then it feels really good when you hit them. You know, when I was working on indie hackers in the beginning, my step one was just to get 10 people to say yes to you doing an interview. And like, that was a huge milestone for me. It took like a week of lots of emails to random people who I didn't know, but like eventually 10 people said yes. And like, I felt great. And that was a huge accomplishment for me. And then just getting the interviews on a website was like a really big accomplishment. And then like launching it was a big accomplishment. And so in like 3 weeks, I had like 3 wins versus it being, you know, this one process. And so I think it's something that more people could think about is how can you break up your plan into little segments, and how can you make sure that every one of those feels really good to you so you're motivated to keep going on and you don't quit? Because the only thing that can really kill your business is you quitting.
Exactly. Oh, that's so true. And I see that happen in the community and other people I speak to, you know, on Twitter and so forth. They've been working on an idea for like 2 years, maybe. It's like a side hustle. They've lost that focus on milestones. They've lost that focus on goals. And it probably is transforming into less of a fun thing to do and more of a burden. So that's like a really important reminder. Thanks for bringing it up. Okay, so I'm going to move on to, I feel like this is quite, I mean, it's an exciting topic, but it's also a difficult topic. And that is the topic of launching. And I feel like the reason why I think it's a difficult topic is, you know, I am on the community team at Product Hunt. I support makers on their launch days. People invest an incredible amount of energy and also an incredible amount of emotion into their launch days. And ultimately, there are variables beyond our control. You know, how many folks end up clicking onto your landing page, signing up to your mailing list, et cetera. Before I jump into the kind of emotional roller coaster that a launch day can be, I thought it might be fun, again, keeping with this theme, to just think of, from a bootstrapping maker's mindset, some launching do's and don'ts. So, Cortland, what are some of launch days or even just launching a product, do's and don'ts?
Launching is another one of those things where I think it's an analogy, right? The analogy is to a rocket launch, right? You're spending all this time putting together this rocket, and it takes years. I mean, you know, all these engineers working, all these scientists figuring out exactly how this rocket's going to work. And then eventually you get to launch day and it's do or die, right? Your launch either explodes in the air or it takes off into space. And it's kind of a useful analogy, I think, but it's also an analogy that can lead you astray. I question the idea that you have to have a singular launch day, or really that that's even the best approach to somebody who's a bootstrapper, to somebody who's an indie hacker. I think it really just comes down to growth. There's just sort of one term, growth, and it's a continuous spectrum. And growth includes everything from launch to those first beta testers who you're talking to, right? How do you go from 0 to 5 people using your thing? How do you go from 5 to 100? How do you go from 100 to 1,000? These aren't discrete points to me. It's just one continuous spectrum. And launch, in my opinion, is just a tool that you can use to sort of help you get to the next level when it's appropriate. So the biggest launch don't, in my opinion, is to sort of mindlessly decide that like the first contact you should have with people is your launch, right? The first time customers should see what you're building is your launch. That doesn't need to be the case. I don't think a rocket ship is a really good analogy to a startup or an app built by a maker. I think what you should be doing is building things much quicker that are much less well-tested than a rocket ship. And I think you should actually put them in users' hands immediately as soon as you possibly can and get them using it. I think by the time you get to your launch day, you should already have people who are using what you're building. You should already know sort of what the reaction is going to be. And your launch should ideally be a tool that you use, like I was saying earlier, to get you to the next level. So I'll give you an example with Indie Hackers. It took me about 3 weeks from idea to the point where I had a website built. But that entire time I was telling people, hey, come check out my website, right? Check out these interviews. What do you think? And I got a lot of good feedback from people that I told about the website about the interviews. And so when it came time to quote unquote launch Indie Hackers, well, there already were readers of Indie Hackers, and I already sort of knew what readers thought of the website. And I had already fixed a lot of bugs and issues. I'd added questions to my interview process that I didn't have earlier. And so my launch goal was really just to sort of collect as many emails as I can. So I put a mailing list collection form on the website the day before I launched. And my launch goal was to sort of build a mailing list so that I would have people that I could continually redirect back to the site when I published new interviews. And that was my goal. It wasn't like a first touch with the world, like with a rocket launch. It was more so like, yeah, the site's already up and working. I just want to accomplish this next level. The problem is if you don't really expect a launch to be like that, what happens is you launch and things go really well. And then 9 times out of 10, even if they did go really well, the next few weeks, all that traffic is gone.
Yes.
All those people have left. And you didn't expect that. And you didn't really have a plan from here because your launch wasn't something that you used to get to the next level. You weren't really thinking one step ahead. And I think that's a very preventable problem. It's very common. So I would say, you know, avoid looking at your launch as a singular thing. And realize that like growth and getting people to whatever you're building is a continuous process. And you should think about that from the beginning.
Yes, I love that. It's true. I feel like it's almost part of the human condition where we tend to see things in quite a binary way, you know, like succeed or fail, on or off, launched or not launched. And you're absolutely right. It shouldn't be this, you know, dot on the timeline of before and after, but rather a continuous process building on those goals of whether it's growth or engagement, whatever is that key metric for you and thinking about it in that way. I also just maybe wanted to pick your brains a bit more around the theme of launching. And let's say going back to this example of a consumer app that my friend's working on, do you feel that founders should, almost similar to like a marketing campaign, like how a new film or Netflix series might launch, try to think of all the different channels they are going to leverage when they've got, you know, the public version of their product, you know, live on the App Store, ready to play with. Are there any like best practices that you've seen that seem to work?
Yeah, I think if you're an indie hacker, like the launch really doesn't need to be this tremendous affair that you devote all your resources to. It's not like you need to target every single channel from day one, blast it out everywhere. But there are some things you can do that'll help. But I'm personally of the bias that like you shouldn't put launch on a pedestal. It shouldn't be this ridiculously important singular day where all of your eggs are in this one basket. But it does help to do some other things. So the number one thing I think you can do for a launch is to build an audience beforehand. Generally speaking, if you're going to launch on Product Hunt or Hacker News, if you're going to tweet what you've done and reveal it to the world or pitch press, ideally you want people who are sort of already on your team supporting you, who can help you amplify this launch, who can help retweet it, who can help upvote it, who can help leave positive comments. And so if I were you, I would already started a mailing list before you've launched. I would be telling people about what you're building transparently, tell them about the process of what you're creating before you've launched, tweet about it. People really like to read behind the scenes stuff. People really like to learn about how things are made. And so it's not that difficult if you can sort of force yourself to be vocal about what you're building while you're building it, to build this kind of initial audience. And so that way on day number one when you launch, you can email this audience and say, hey, I'm launching here. Thanks so much for following my journey. Would appreciate your support. And some people might help you. Maybe they won't. But I think that really can help amplify a launch if that's what you're going for. Besides that, I think you should really think about the different channels that appeal to your particular audience. And so earlier I was saying that depending on what you're making, yeah, part of your idea is like what it is that you're building, but part of like what makes a good business idea good is the people that you're targeting. Like who do you want to use? Are you targeting teachers? Is this for developers? Is this for other makers? Is it for, you know, stay-at-home moms? Whoever you have in mind for being like the ideal user for the thing you're creating, they probably have watering holes that they gather at on the internet. They probably have places, you know, that only really they go and they share information with each other. You should have those in mind as places where you could launch. I think it's very easy to just sort of say, well, everyone else launches on Product Hunt, so that's where I'm going to launch. And you probably should launch on Product Hunt because there's so many new early adopters there who want to use different new things. But you should also launch in the area where like your target market, like your ideal users actually congregate. Otherwise, you're missing a huge opportunity. So I would say try to figure out what that is before you launch. And you're only really going to figure out what that is if you are one of your ideal users or you spend a lot of time talking to them.
Yes, I agree. Thanks for bringing that up, because I think similar to what you were saying earlier, where we perhaps take our cues from big global tech companies when we should be looking at folks who are only a few steps ahead of us, there is often a tendency for makers to go where the biggest audience is in the hope that, you know, X percent will convert into followers, subscribers, downloads. In reality, if you go to a more narrow focused platform, like you said, where your target users are, you know, where you hang out, if you're building a product for your demographic or your audience, you're probably going to end up with far higher engagement, even though the total pool is smaller, just because you're really, you know, connecting to the folks that have the problem you're trying to solve or will find value in the product that you're launching. So yeah, I think you're right. Don't fall victim to playing the numbers game when you could be playing the find the narrow focus game, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's a little bit like quality over quantity.
Exactly. Awesome. So now we've launched, our product is out there, and maybe we didn't do that prep. So we didn't build that audience. We didn't really start engaging with the people who could use our product, help us amplify the message that we're out there. So we're struggling to find our first users. This is something that we talk about all the time on the platform. You've got makers who've spent so long building a product, sadly have not put a lot of focus onto building an audience, and now they are struggling to find their first users. If one finds themselves in that situation, what are the do's and don'ts? What could work and what should be avoided?
First step, don't fret. Don't get worried. Remember, launch is just one of many steps along this continuous path of growth. There really is no such thing as launch. You can keep launching over and over again into the future. You didn't blow your one shot. So don't get discouraged. And I say that because, again, I think quitting is like the number one bad thing you can do. The only reason your business is going to fail is because you quit. So keep going. Figure out what lessons you learned from your launch. Figure out why it didn't do well. Did people not like it? Talk to people. Probably if you've gotten to the point where you've launched something and it didn't do well, you've already passed up the opportunity to talk to people, because if you've been talking to people, you should have some idea in mind of how they think about the thing that you've been creating. So I would say go back to the drawing board a little bit and start talking to people, which is probably something you've been neglecting. Step two, figure out like these distribution channels that I was talking about earlier, right? Your launch is not the only time you can get users. And really, like, if you've built something that's good and people seem to like it, you just need to find out where those people are. So this goes back to what we were saying, like, who are your actual target customers? Where do they hang out online? I talked to a guy, his name is Dominic Wells. He has a company called Human Proof Designs. I had him on the podcast, and like, his best users are on Flippa. These people are just like buying and selling each other's websites. And he had a product that would basically give you an idea for a website that you could buy and sell. And you would buy these ideas from him. So he was like, oh, all these people who are like, are totally in my wheelhouse, hang out on this place, Flippa, I need to go there. And like, he was struggling to grow before he found that channel, but then he found it and it was much better for him. And there's a lot of other stories like that on Indie Hackers, where I talk to people who are now making, you know, 10-20K a month from their products, but earlier on they were just stuck and had no idea how to get users. So I think a lot of it is just a process of like sticking with it and really just hammering out these different channels. And even if you don't get it right on your launch day, it's totally okay. Like, later on you could figure it out. So don't get discouraged.
I love that. Definitely like not quitting. I think Ryan once said this on Twitter. He was helping review some founders' Y Combinator applications. And one of the founders had said something along the lines of, you know, this is our make or break. If we don't get in, that's it. You know, we're killing the project. And Ryan was like, well, that's really concerning because you should want to work on this regardless of the outcome of, you know, ultimately an application, right? There's so many other things that will still happen, so many other milestones on the horizon for this product if you really care about it. So yeah, I think you're right. Just making sure that you keep going, even if the launch didn't turn out the way you did, is so important. I also think it kind of comes back to something that I see a lot of founders talking about more and more on social media, which is this idea of resilience. I think to succeed as a founder, and I'm sure you have a lot of lessons from this, having been through so many cycles of founding yourself, it's really important to be able to pick ourselves up when things don't go to plan. And that's almost like, well, I see it anyway, like a muscle that we have to exercise. And the more often we go through experiences where things don't work out as planned, but we keep going and learn from it and keep moving forward, the better we become at dealing with situations where things don't go to plan.
Totally. And there's some like hacks that you can use to make it easier on yourself. So you don't have to have as big of a deal with disaster muscle, right? You can, for example, if you're building lots of things by yourself, but having trouble, have a co-founder. Find someone else who's a maker who is interested in the same things that you are interested in, which is not that hard to do nowadays with websites like Product Hunt. You guys have Product Hunt makers and discussions now with Indie Hackers. Find someone else who shares your interests and you could talk to this person about it. And like, the psychological benefits of working with someone else are often tremendous, and they can help you basically not quit when the going gets tough. If you have somebody else who's sort of in it with you, start small. Build really small things. Just because you might have grand ambitions down the road doesn't mean that the thing you're building needs to start off grand. Most websites, most companies that you've heard of that are really huge nowadays started tiny. You know, there was a time when Walmart was a really tiny corner store, right? And they grew gradually from that. And so I think starting small is a really good way to sort of preserve your morale, because if things don't go well, then you haven't invested all that much time. And if things do go well, you really like, you can really, I guess, take advantage of the optionality that you have to either make it into something bigger or to keep it small and polish it, et cetera. So I think starting small is a pretty underrated advantage that not enough people talk about, but it's the people I've seen who sort of continued through adversity is because they've built something that's small. They got it out into customers' hands really early. Like, any sort of lack of success wasn't that hard for them to deal with, and any success was like extra good. A good example I'll talk about is Josh Pickford of Bear Metrics. I think he built his app in something like 7 days from idea to first paying customer. And like, that's no time, right? He committed almost nothing. He wasn't invested. If it didn't go well, oh well, it was 7 days, you know? But then from there, he's like, oh, this is cool. Maybe I should like make it better. So I think he went back to the drawing board and like rebuilt his whole app. But he already at that point had sort of validated that people would pay for it, right? So I think starting small is something all of us can kind of learn from.
I love that. That is such good advice. It's very practical and doable as well. So I'm going to remember that next time I'm launching something or kicking off.
Well, the hard part about it is how do you, when you've started small on something, sort of stair step that into something bigger? The analogy I like to use is a climbing wall, right? It's really hard to just jump to the top of a climbing wall. But if you put your first foot on the first step at the bottom of the climbing wall and you press up, that'll give you a little bit of a height advantage that makes reaching the second step easier. So with Indie Hackers, for example, well, okay, I want to build this huge online community of founders helping each other. How do I do that? Well, if I put out interviews, maybe that's good enough to launch those on Product Hunt. And if I put a mailing list sort of email collection form on the website, then I can build a newsletter, and the newsletter will let me reach people over and over again. Then if I build a community, I can send out those conversations to people on the newsletter, and that'll start to populate the community. And then if the community is sort of self-sustaining and lots of people are in there, then I can use that to, like, I don't know, build an audience for a podcast. And so each one of these steps is like small in and of itself, but it helps provide some advantage to get to the next level. And I think that's something a lot of people don't realize is even possible.
Agreed. That's brilliant. That actually leads me on to the next theme I wanted to touch on with you. And let's say you have started small. So you're working full time and you kick off a project as a side hustle. You're bootstrapping, you are gaining traction, you're actually making some money now. I wanted to get your insight on a dilemma that lots of bootstrapping makers find themselves in, where their side hustle is actually really starting to pick up. And as it's picking up, it's also more demanding of their time and their resources. And they ask themselves a question, should I transition to working on this full time? I'd love to get your insight on the kind of questions a maker should ask themselves to help make that decision.
First of all, do you like what you're working on? And the sort of barometer I use is like, do I like the customers that I'm serving? The people who are paying for what I'm building, are these people I will be friends with? Are these people who I want to talk to and email and meet for the next few years? Because that's probably what you're going to be doing. And you really don't want to quit your job and go full-time into something that you don't like working on. Because the whole point of doing this is to enjoy your life. There's no point in starting something like this if it's not going to make your life better. So that's like step one. Make sure you actually like what you're doing. Step two, you have to really look at your own financial situation. For Indie Hackers, I quit my job cold turkey because I saved up about a year's worth of rent. And I said, I'm going to use this money to invest in myself and build this. And so I already kind of took that risk. For a lot of people, and you know, this will depend on who you are, like you've got a family or a mortgage or a really high paying job you're not sure you could easily replace, etc. You really need to take that into account. Don't get overly optimistic at like the first sign of success, but also make sure that like if you do this, you're not going to regret it because you've like ruined your financial situation, which luckily I don't hear as much about as I used to. When I first moved to SF, I heard so many stories of people racking up tons of credit card debt and also like just all sorts of terrible things. You should never do that for your indie hacker business. There's really no point. It's just going to make you more stressed and make your life worse. And again, the point is to make your life better. Other questions are about growth, I think. Like, what kind of potential does this thing actually have to get big? Is this the right thing for you to invest in so heavily? I would advise you, if you've got like something that you're doing on the side and it's getting big enough to the point where like you can even consider quitting your job, see how far you can stretch it. Like, how far can you go with the constraint that you still have a full-time job and this other side business is just a side business, right? That constraint will force you to be creative in some ways. You won't be able to build certain things that you wish you had time to build, but that's okay. Maybe you could still get it bigger. I think that reduces the risk of quitting your job and ending up working on something that's not going to work very well. I think it's very easy to get sucked into this idea that, oh, if only I quit my job, I would have so much more free time and I'd be able to do all this stuff. No matter what, no matter how much free time you have, whatever it is that you're building, if you're focused on one thing, I guarantee you there's more stuff to build. There's more stuff to create. There's more ideas that you'll have than you have time to do. Whether or not that time you have is 40 hours a week or whether it's just nights and weekends after work, you're still not going to have enough time to do what you need to do. And so it's important to sort of develop that muscle of prioritization and restraint and figuring out, okay, well, what things actually need to get made and what things can wait. And so I think you can do that while you keep your full-time job and you don't necessarily have to make this huge risky decision to quit.
Agreed. I think that's wonderful. It's so important. I was at a talk the other day by a founder and he was saying, you know, we as individuals have to calculate what that risk reward dynamic is that suits us. And you're absolutely right. It is a very, very personal one. You know, the reward of going full time might not be as great as you think it could be if you don't enjoy interacting with that audience every day. Or maybe you actually really like your full time job and you can find a way to make both work and it isn't quite right to move away from that yet. So again, I love this idea of like creating these frameworks, trying as much as possible. I feel like the advice that you're giving is almost like trying as much as possible to make objective decisions where we might otherwise fall victim to subjective ones, like doing whatever we can to agree the priorities or the goals. And then with the information we have available, fitting them into that to make the next best decision. Is that fair?
Yeah. And there's people who disagree with me. I'm a very analytical person. I like planning. I like trying to figure things out as objectively as possible. Of course, we're all biased. And of course, there's a lot of noise in the data, so we're never going to be perfect. But my point of view is kind of like, you're not the first person to do this, right? You're not the first maker. You're not the first indie hacker. You're not the first person to create a business. Other people have done this stuff, and they've run into all sorts of roadblocks, and they've written literally books about their lessons. And you have two choices, right? You can either repeat their mistakes, or you can try to learn sort of in absentia from their mistakes so you don't have to repeat them. And I always fall on the side of like that second approach. Try to learn from other people's horrible mistakes. Try not to spend your entire life repeating those mistakes yourself. There's some lessons that are just much harder to learn unless they're through your own personal experience. I think a lot of those are what sink first-time founders and makers you're trying to generate revenue. For example, sort of unwavering optimism you have as the creator that your thing is going to work and that people like it, right? It's very hard to believe that this thing that you think is going to be great, other people won't think it's going to be great, which is why a lot of first-time makers neglect talking to their users and trying to like run these tests and validate their ideas because, it's going to work. I'm going to launch it. It's going to be fine. Some of those lessons you might have to learn the hard way because they're emotional, psychological lessons. But once you do, then you can put a system into place of like, okay, well, here's how I actually talk to users. Here's how I validate this stuff. So I think a lot of it is just figuring out what the roadblocks are going to be, figuring out if those are things you can learn from other people. That's why I created Indie Hackers. There's hundreds of interviews. You could just go there and read how other people have done it and see what roadblocks come up over and over again. And that should give you a little bit of confidence as to what you can do. But again, people disagree. A lot of people believe that you should do everything based on intuition, feeling it out, and there's no playbook that's going to tell you how to do it. So I think it really depends on your personality.
Yeah, that's true, actually. That's such a good point. Like, what feels right to you? Because you also don't want to... I was playing with my goddaughter the other day. She's like 1 year old, and she has this game, and it's like a cube with different shapes cut out all around it. And then she has other shapes, like 3D objects, that she tries to fit in to the matching holes. And these two different ways of thinking remind me of that game because, if you're like triangle-shaped thinker, don't try to push yourself into the circle-shaped way of thinking. You also, in a way, have to do what feels right so that you don't always feel like you're struggling against something that doesn't connect with you. So that's a helpful reminder too.
Totally agree. And it's super important for starting a business too because you don't want to start a business somebody else told you to start that you don't like, you're not enjoying. And so you really have to understand who you are as a person. I've started lots of businesses that, quite frankly, weren't really who I am. I've started like productivity software stuff. Like, I don't care about productivity software. I'm not like a productivity geek. I never read Getting Things Done. It's like, why was I doing that? It's not surprising that I eventually quit. Whereas when I started a business that was related to something that I'm genuinely interested in, like Indie Hackers is like these are all my people. It's the people I would want to talk to every day anyway. Suddenly I'm much better equipped. So I think you're totally right. You need to figure out, are you a triangle person? Are you a circle person? And that should inform your decisions just as much as sort of all the objective business strategy type things.
I'm so sad that our time is drawing to an end because I feel like now I have even more questions that I want to ask you for our maker community. But you are a CEO and I know I have to let you go soon. So the final theme I want to get your advice on is the theme of setting metrics, or rather choosing metrics. All makers want to use data to improve once their product is out in the world, interacting with their audience. What should makers avoid, really not do, when they are setting their success metrics or deciding what those KPIs are?
This is a great example of a time where you should not copy what big companies are doing. Every large company has hundreds of people in the marketing department and the development department. And a lot of those people are just measuring and tracking and analyzing things down to the most minute detail. Whereas when I talk to lots of indie hackers on my podcast and my website, what I find is it's very common for people who are very successful to say, yeah, we don't track hardly anything. I track very few metrics, et cetera. And the reason is because it's not because metrics aren't useful to track. It's because there's an opportunity cost to everything you do, right? If you're spending your time setting up your Google Analytics or your Mixpanel for days, like that's days where you're not doing other things. And quite frankly, like that stuff is not that important, especially early on. You're going to get a lot more valuable data just by talking to people, by actually building features and seeing how they perform. You're going to get by like tweaking the tiniest things based on A/B tests and metrics, et cetera. So step one, don't spend a ton of time up front tracking your metrics. Step two, whatever you do track, make sure it's actually something that you really care about. And this goes back to sort of like the stair steps, sort of the climbing wall the milestones we were talking about, where you always sort of know that you're just at one step along the process to your ultimate goal. Track whatever metric is going to get you to that next step, right? If I needed 1,000 email subscribers before I felt good launching a community forum, that's the metric that I tracked. And all the other metrics don't matter. You can drive yourself crazy tracking a bunch of stuff that doesn't matter. And quite frankly, even if you do well at those metrics, like, it doesn't feel that good. If I see that 10,000 people have downloaded something or watched something or read something, like, that's just a number. It doesn't feel amazing. And unless I'm going to make a new decision based on tracking that metric, I think it's kind of just a waste of time. So my bias is track very few metrics and don't buy into them too much, and make sure you know sort of how they fit into your overall roadmap.
I love that. That's so helpful. And the reason why it's so important to remember that is because, like you just mentioned earlier, time is so precious when one is a maker. There are so many competing demands of time and so many priorities to set. And ultimately, if it's just not going to be the most effective lever to move you closer to your milestone, don't spend that energy on it. That's wonderful. Thank you so much. Okay, so Cortland, you have given us so many great tips in this special episode of what not to do when bootstrapping and what not to do as a maker. This is one of my favorite parts of the show. Being the Product Hunt Radio podcast, we cannot let you go without talking to you about the products that you love. So this might be the apps that are on your home screen, or maybe some hardware that you're playing around with at home. This is where I give you the floor so you can share with the audience what those products are.
Number one has got to be Notion. I'm obsessed with Notion. I like moved all of my docs from Google Docs into Notion a couple months ago, and I have not looked back. It's amazing. It's like you can do whatever you want in Notion. And I'm super excited to see that they raised money recently, and they're going to be building a lot more features, doing a lot more cool stuff with that. Can't wait to see what they add. But right now, it's already like the perfect document editor for me, and like I can't imagine a better tool. So I'm a big fan of others. I like Airtable, for example, but Notion, it just seems like they got it right.
I love Notion. Yeah, it's crazy. $800 million valuation. We've been talking about it in Product Hunt. It was one of the headline stories, I think, in the newsletter. There'll probably be a unicorn soon enough. I feel like if someone was listening now and they're like, oh, so you moved all your Google Docs from Notion, is it just like Google Docs? How would you describe it?
I use like all of Notion's features. So they have this like concept of a database in Notion, which is just sort of like a, I guess like a table where every row has all this information. So I've got like, I used to use Asana, for example, for my weekly tasks. I don't use Asana anymore. I use Notion for all of my task management. I write a lot. I just like write essays, ideas for blog posts. I use Notion for all of that. I do planning with my team at Indie Hackers. We collaborate on Notion for that. Sort of my entire home base for how I organize my life personally and at work is all in Notion. I think the cool thing about it is it's got like this embed feature where you can embed things from pretty much any website. Like you can embed a YouTube video in your Notion, for example. You can embed a Google Doc in your Notion document. It's just powerful. I like the idea that I can not just have a task list, but I can also have documents and notes and like just freeform writing sort of in line and around my task list. And so I use literally like whatever you can imagine if it involves writing of some kind. Yeah, it's happening in my Notion.
I love, first of all, the aesthetics of Notion because it just looks so good. And the intuition behind everything is awesome. Like, let's say you're just like starting a new project. You can like choose a cover image. They've got this like incredible library of images that you can choose. They've got an integration with Unsplash. So every time you start a new page or do something new, you know, you can personalize it in some way or just like, you know, add a bit of pizzazz. You can also like assign like emojis to headings and give them character that way. So I feel like there are also so many delightful elements to the product that I love too. But I think most of all, the reason why I prefer it to Google Docs is because you're navigating it almost like a website. You know, you can create your own headers, you can create your own links, you can create your own menus. And Google Docs has changed, but it hasn't really changed to that degree. The actual like navigation is still pretty dry and very much like a directory. So it's quite fun how customizable Notion can be too in terms of turning into a website. So yeah, I definitely think folks should check it out if they haven't yet. Well, Cortland, we have come to the end of the hour. I'm very sad because I've enjoyed our conversation so much and now it has to end. For folks who are listening and want to find out more, they want to learn more from you, they want to learn more from the community, where should they go?
Thanks, Abadesi, so much for having me on the podcast. For people who want to learn more about Indie Hackers, if you're considering starting a business, I highly recommend you check out the Indie Hackers podcast. Just go to www.indiehackers.com. There's a link to the podcast up top. Or you can check out the community forum, which is right there on the homepage. I tweet pretty rarely, but when I do, it's from twitter.com/CSAllen. So those are sort of the places you can go to get familiar with the Indie Hackers community.
Awesome. Thanks again, Cortland. It's been great having you.
Thanks, Abadesi.
Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week. But in the meantime, share the podcast with your friends on Twitter and tag a guest you'd like to hear in a future episode. See you soon.